Hello, and welcome to Be Indie Now, a podcast about independent game development. I'm your host, Tobiah Marks, and with me today is Catherine Harris.
Hi.
And special guest, David No.
Hello.
David, you and Don started Lockhart, right?
Yes.
When did you guys start your company?
I think we started about 2 years ago.
Cool.
So yeah, like 2011. And we started it after we had met at a Facebook gaming company.
Oh, cool. Where did you guys work before? Can you say?
Yeah, it was a company that was called NeoEdge and had traditionally done like advertising, sort of in-game video ads kind of type of stuff. But then they wanted to branch out and make some Facebook games of their own. And so they brought on a bunch of people from PopCap. And was it PopCap? I don't know. There was some other company that they had brought in some people from, and they wanted to make some Facebook games. So they hired Don as a main developer of that. And then I was more of the marketing and analytics side of things.
Cool. So do you guys were wanting to go home and make games after work?
Yeah, well, honestly, I won't say the name of the game, but it was pretty terrible game.
Oh, don't worry. Like, everyone's first release is never your proudest moment.
No, and the cool thing was that Don and I, we had cubicles next to each other, and I actually ripped out the wall in between us just because I thought he was a really cool guy. So I was like, I'm going to, have more conversations with this guy. So I had this, hole in between our, cubicle walls, and he would be working on the game, and I would be, analyzing it, and you know, we were both in our own ways, telling our bosses, this game is not doing well. Clearly we need to move on to, other things. And they weren't really listening. And there's, issues with, maintaining reputations with investors and stuff like that. And a whole bunch of other politics, whatever, typical stuff. And so Don and I, we kind of resonated with each other because, I just asked him what he thought about games, what makes a good game. And instead of talking about graphics or game mechanics or any of the typical things that usually people talk about, he was like, it's all about emotion. It's all about the experience that the player gets from the game. And I had never heard of a developer say that outright, an engineer, kind of I was like, whoa, I didn't know.
It's definitely a good attitude to approach it.
Yeah, so that was really intriguing to me. So from then on, we had lots of fruitful conversations about game design, and then he left eventually to start his own thing, and he eventually pulled me in as well. So
Don started Lockhart.
Yeah, pretty much. He didn't really have a name for it, but I was like, so what are you gonna call your one-man company? He's like, I don't know, I like the word Lockhart. And I was like, okay, I don't know what that means, and I don't really care because it sounds okay to me.
So what does it mean, actually?
It doesn't really mean anything. He actually thought of it from a I think the story was sort of he had some sort of you have to ask him personally about this, but he had some personal affection for the word, but also he thought it'd be nice because it has a heart aspect, so it has sort of a feminine emotional quality, but lock sounds very I don't know, maybe masculine and or, strong, I guess, in some ways.
So, nice. I like how much you thought about it. When I was naming my companies, it was more like, oh, is it taken up by Bean already on Google? Okay, that's us. it has spirit and passion, and it conveys love through these emotions.
I mean, that's a lot of BS behind it, but I mean,
well, BS is good when you're talking about a name, right? All names are kind of BS to a degree.
Yes, that's true. But ultimately, we both decided that, since I didn't put anything, I was like, fine, I don't really care, because ultimately, it's all about the products, right? Because people attribute good products with the brand eventually, right? And it doesn't really matter what the name is, Google, all these names that, if you think about it, are ridiculous names. They're just Hulu,
exactly.
It's so stupid, but because we associate a good product with it, we give it a lot of slack.
It just has to be easy to remember.
Right.
That's the one caveat to that.
Right. Exactly.
So, was your first project Sprite Lock, or was it something else?
Yeah. So that was an interesting thing. I mean, originally we wanted to make games, right? You know, we wanted to make mobile games, and we wanted to make, you know, really fun games. And that was sort of the goal of our company. We had started in the platform Corona, because that we thought that was, you know, the simplest platform to build our game on, and we wanted to get quick, you know, with the iteration. So we thought that was a really good platform, and obviously you used it as well.
I love Corona.
Yeah, and we loved the community. You know, back when Corona was first starting, and we wanted to sort of be a part of that community, to give back to the community. So Don had, just for our purposes, been making this Flash exporter for all of our sprites and our artwork, and it was really kind of a crappy thing that he threw together, but it worked for us. And since I'd been making everything in Flash, it was sort of a very custom tool for our purposes. But we thought, hey, you know, why not make this tool available to the community? And at first we just wanted to send it out as it was, just kind of this shitty tool and just give it free and just say, hey, by the way, we're making a game, like, we're Lockhart, here's this free tool. And we showed it to Carlos at a meetup, and Carlos was the CEO
of Corona SDK at the time, and one of the co-founders,
right? So we had showed it to him at a meetup just as a happenstance thing, like, hey, check out this thing we made. And he told us, you know, he's like, well, are you guys funded? Like, how are you guys going to pay for, you know, your game development? And we're like, no, we're just bootstrapping. He's like, you know, this might sell. You know, if you sell just a small amount, you might be able to make enough, what he called diaper money. We didn't have any kids, but he called it diaper money. I don't know.
Oh, yeah. He always has funny names for things, diaper money, pizza money.
Right, exactly. So we thought, oh, well, you know, maybe that would be beneficial, because, you know, maybe we would spend more time on making the tool really good, since we, now, you know, maybe we'd have a profit motive, and we'd make it really polished, and then that would even be better for the community. So we're like, yeah, let's keep the price low, and let's just make it a really high quality tool. And we called it Sprite Lock, and we put it out there, and it was well received. With, you know, there was a lot of more Flash developers out there, and people who just wanted, like, a really simple, easy-to-use tool to get their artwork into the game. So
tell us exactly what it did, too, for people out there who haven't heard of it before. Took your Swift assets.
I might be making a mistake, because Don, like, did all the engineering behind it. I just designed the UI, but...
Well, fair enough, right? It just takes you have your animation, and you can export into a format that Corona could input it really easily, different frames to, you know, can determine how much. Yeah, it was a really cool tool. I remember when I first saw it, I forgot which one of you two showed me. We were at some Corona meetup, and I was like, that is incredibly handy.
Yeah, it was really easy. I mean, I'm not even an engineer, and I was able to use it, like, really easily. I mean, it was, especially from the artist's standpoint, I mean, I could put physics shapes onto it as well, like, define the boundaries and also align things. You know, and that was a really big issue with a lot of other sprite stuff. It's like aligning them so that, you know, they are at the right reference point. And there's all these little tiny things with the tool that was sort of made it stand out amongst the competition.
Awesome. So it was a huge hit. You guys were able to, like, go full time because of Sprite Lock, or was it just, you know, giving you some extra diaper money?
It was, like Carlos said, it was giving us diaper money. And we actually, going into it, we didn't understand that there was actually be a lot of support costs to it, because, you know, there's always people asking questions and have custom needs, you know, for the tool. And we were constantly being pulled in two different directions, sort of like, you know, do we the support stuff for Sprite Lock, or do we work on this game? And so on the one hand, it was great in the sense that it got our name out there. We were helping lots of people, and we were making, you know, enough money to pay for some food, you know, for lunch or something like that. But ultimately, it started actually becoming a distraction to our game development. So we were actually constantly looking for a way out of it, but it was great, you know, like it really did open up a lot of doors for us.
Yeah, that's so. When did you? What was your next game after, like, Sprite Lock came out?
During Sprite Lock.
So during Sprite Lock, our first mobile game was called Cannon Cat, and you have to remember, back in 2011, that's only 2 years ago. But the industry has changed.
Did Cannon Cat come out
in
2011 or was it 2012?
It came out in 2012 in April. Yeah. So
I remember you were working on it forever.
I know.
I don't mean to be mean with that, too. I mean, no, you were working on it for a lot longer than I work on my games.
It's fine. A lot of other developers we had talked to, they were like, dude, you should only spend more than like 4 months on a game. That's it, max, you know? And we had definitely spent upwards of like 8 to 9 months, you know, and at least double the amount of time that most people did, and maybe even more like after that. So yeah, it took us a long time. It took us only a month to make the prototype, but we had polished like the crap out of that game. Like we were just never satisfied. We wanted to make it like a really amazing game. And, you know, ultimately it paid off in the sense that, you know, Apple featured us. And we got a lot of great reviews. So in that sense, it did pay off to spend that more extra time on
yeah, a lot of indies I talk to, and I'm a huge advocate of, you know, the release early and often, get it out there and iterate on it, get it in front of people. And you kind of took this completely different approach to it where you're like, no, we finished this game in a month, but we're just going to polish it and tweak it and make it better. And you did, like, put all these levels in it, and you made just everything was tight, the graphics are amazing in it, it was super super fun. Mm-hmm. I love Cannon Cat. It's still on my phone.
I mean, ultimately, I think the real difference was that we were attacking two different platforms, and we were going iOS like solely. Mm-hmm. And judging from like even at that time the bar of quality at that point, plus Apple didn't have and still doesn't really a quick iteration turnover, right? Because you have to go through the App Store for every single build, and at that time there was no like workaround in terms of iterating quickly. And so I think with you guys, and I'm sure, you know, maybe your audience knows your background or whatever, your game development
store. For my Blast Monkeys experience, right. we were like, oh yeah, it's a 48-hour prototype, we'll throw it up on the store,
right?
You
right.
know, like Blast Monkeys was not, it was not popular or profitable for like the first 4 months, but that was just how it was, because by 4 months in, we had worked on it for 4 months, and then it reached that bar.
I mean, so in that way, that was our strategy. And in terms of, you know, like you had mentioned before, like, you know, how do we get featured, all the marketing, all of this buzz around our game at the time, that was because I had made a conscious effort to create what I called a perfect storm around our launch. And that was like, I wanted to build up, you know, press releases. I wanted to build up reviews from different sites. I wanted to have, you know, the editors at Apple take a look at it. I wanted to have everything happen at all at once. And because at the time, the advice was that, you know, basically to cut through the noise and also to get higher up on the rankings and keep that way, you have to sort of have everyone sort of reviewing and talking about your game, you know, all at the same time. And that's sort of what had happened. And that was actually a long, long period of marketing. You know, like I always say, and Don always gives advice to the indie devs is, you know, you don't save marketing for, you know, the 2 weeks before you launch. That's like a big mistake. Well, you have to start from the very, very beginning.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. Do you, with your background in marketing, though, you said you had a background in marketing instead of engineering. Do you advise other indie people to have at least someone on their team have some sort of background in marketing or business, since it seemed to pay off for y'all?
Yeah, sort of. I mean, I wouldn't say you need a sole person who's a marketing guy. Like, I'm actually an engineer. I was an aerospace engineer before this, and then I was a product designer. And so Don and I actually equally have, like, weird I don't know. I would say like a generalist backgrounds. Like we are very interested in everything, and we like to get involved in all aspects of the company. And when you're an indie, when you're a startup, you have to do that. You have to be
a generalist at some point.
Exactly. Right. You have to be good at several things. And I would say you don't have to have any background or any specialty in marketing to do marketing. You just have to know. You just have to have that hat on, right? You just have to look at it from perspective of, okay, I have this great game. I think it's a great game, but how the heck does anyone even know about my game, and how do they know that it's a good game, right? And you have to know, one, how to break through the noise and pitch your game. And then two, like, what is it about your game that's even worth pitching, right? Like, why would anyone care about your game, really?
So, follow-up question, how do you break through the noise, right? Like, yeah. I love, right. like, everything you're saying, I agree with. I've told tons of other people before. I've maybe tried to have done it myself, but compared to the amount of success I've seen you have with it, I've seen you get, you know, press way more often than I've seen for my game.
Yeah.
And you, I don't know, is it the way you email those blogs? Is it just the numbers?
Do you have a template that you can send out to people? It's like, you should use this.
Yeah, here. Yeah, yeah. All you got to do is say the magic three words and they'll listen to you. What?
All the doors will open.
Please, David, tell us the secret three words that we all need to know.
Well, okay, first off, disclaimer, I'm not an expert, and I wouldn't say I have as incredible amount of success with marketing. I obviously there's way better examples out there of people who have, you know, cut through the noise, you know. But having said that, my pointers are, well, one, there's no panacea, right? That it's not some secret formula like you're asking for that'll just like fill everything out. It's really one, it's just being a human to these people is primary. Like, one, you have to look at from their perspective. You have to have empathy for them, right? So if you're a game reviewer, if that's your intent to get a game review, they're very busy. They're seeing hundreds of games all the time, right? And they don't have the time and or they don't want to put the effort into, like, giving everyone, you know, the benefit of the doubt and just looking into your game. They have to be hooked in immediately. And so you have to make their job easier. And you have to treat them like a human. You can't just send them the same email that you sent everyone else. And they'll know if you sent out some template and you just replace, you know, their name. And that's really dangerous anyways, because you'll just make a mistake one time and send to Touch Arcade, you know, that you pay 148 apps and it's like, no, they're Touch Arcade, right? Like, you have to No, and to even to get to know
yeah,
the
ideally person, you'd be part of those communities ahead of time. You'd be on their forums, not just like, oh, I made an account just to talk about my game. But
exactly,
you know, you're part of that scene. You're a contributor.
Exactly. So you have to be authentic. You have to think of it from their point of view. And so all of that, you know, goes down to little details like, you know, creating a press kit for them or sending them a video ahead of time that, you know, explains everything to them in a really easy way. They just hit play and then they check it out. You know, if they like it, then they'll contact you back. Or, you know, lowering the barrier of entry in the sense of, you know, you're essentially, a lot of people look at it like they're a homeless person on the street asking for change. Like, they're literally asking for a handout. They're like, please, please give me a review. Please check out my game. And that's like not the perspective you should have.
Yeah, you have value. They want the exclusive to talk about your game. They want to talk to you specifically.
Or you could take the perspective of, you're an expert. You're looking at tons of the games. I want your advice. Like, do you like this or do you like this? Or, you know what I mean? Like, it's
appeal to their ego.
So what did you ask them? Did you ask them about, like, game mechanics or art or icons?
Art. Like, something simple, right? Obviously, you're not going to change the entire game for them, right? Unless you've been, you know, like we're planning beta testing and they're a beta tester and you know, they're early in on the development cycle. Then you can ask them about game mechanics and be like, hey, do you like this idea or this idea? But if you're in the position where your game is, like, kind of done, but you're on the marketing side, hey, you could ask them for marketing advice. Hey, I have this video and I have this video, or I have this screenshot and this screenshot. Which do you think would work better? And the barrier to entry to respond to that is really low, right? Because they could just be like, well, I don't even have to review this game, but I can tell them that I like that screenshot better, you know?
Right. So,
and so now that they've opted in, they've, like, thought about the game for 2 seconds, it's on
exactly.
their mind.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that's a really good strategy.
So the
strategy.
Steps are, like, keep it human, keep it simple.
I love that strategy, too, because it has multiple benefits, because you also get good feedback on which screenshots to look at from the people who judge screenshots all day. Right. Like, so that's such a great idea.
Because everyone is always asking for stuff for them, right? And you can also make their job easier. You can also give value to them, like you said, in the sense of, and this is what I mean by thinking about marketing from the beginning. Okay, like, you don't want to be in that position where It's really hard to market your game. You want to make your job as easy as possible from the beginning. So an exercise that Don and I like to do is, you know, especially if you're way early in the game development process and you don't even know what game you want to make. Let's say you have like several ideas. A lot of game developers, they have a plethora of ideas, right? It's just a question of which one should we go for. And if you're at that stage, think about how it would be to pitch that game right now without even knowing like what the game is necessarily, you know, exactly is going to be. Which one do you think would cut through the noise? And ultimately what that does is it generates ideas that are new, that are innovative, that have some sort of twist to them that is differentiating. And if you think of it from the very beginning from that standpoint, then your whole life is easier, right? Because then you know what your pitch is. You know from the very beginning what is it about your game that resonates, you know? And the best way to do that is to test, right? So think of everything as a test. When you go out to your friends, when you are pitching your game, you know, like even before it's done, like literally like here's this screenshot or whatever, I'm working on this game, what do you think, you know, and work on your pitch and iterate on it every time you talk to someone.
So when did you start showing it to people, like reviewers like this, like you're talking about? Was it when it was closer to your done, you know, 8 months in, or was this, you know, month one you started shopping it around?
Well, we learned a lot from Cannon Cat. For Cannon Cat, I was probably a month or two before launch, I was already sort of starting my marketing efforts. You know, with Prestige, we're basically our second game. I'm starting from the very beginning. I'm talking to people. I had already developed relationships with people from Cannon Cat, right? So like building on your relationships, building on your community is really a great thing for, you know, your second time around. And so this time, I'm starting from the beginning. I'm trying to, you know, get beta testers. I'm trying to talk to community people, early adopters, stuff like that. So,
So let's talk about Cannon Cat a bit more because I want to go chronologically. So
sure.
You're working on Cannon Cat. You polish it. You talk to a bunch of reviewers. They give your feedback. You make, you know, the best choice. I remember, you know, you post on Facebook, what do you think, Icon A or Icon B? And you'd post this like every other week. And like you would like have this gauntlet of icons until you got like the perfect one.
Yeah.
You get all of this polish and you have a game that is, you know, frankly, some of the best polish I've seen come out of a two-person indie studio. Like we're talking, you know, Fez quality polish here, in my opinion. It's really solid. You launch it. What happens?
Okay. So here's the dramatic story. If you're not familiar with the Apple sort of featuring process, someone just contacts you and says, hey, one of our editors, you know, likes your game. We would like to possibly feature you. And they never, ever guarantee a feature. They just say, hey, you know, if you want to be considered, send us this artwork, and maybe next week when you launch, we'll feature you.
And so they've been sending you that email before you were even released?
Yeah. So
interesting. Was it after you were approved?
Yeah. Exactly.
Okay. So they had a copy of everything.
They looked through your game, they approved it, and it's the person who approved it, like, right. Said,
probably
oh,
was
hey,
like,
check
this is
out.
Cool.
Yeah. So here's some inside knowledge, like, into how Apple does their thing. This is just through other people who had worked there and who I had known. So I don't know how accurate this is today. But essentially, the people who approve your app are looking through tons of them every day, right, and approving them. And if they like a certain game, they'll tell the person above them. And then that person will tell the person above them. And so there's this hierarchy of filtering of games. And ultimately, there's a small set of editors at the top who make this decision, and they're getting input from all the people below them, and they talk to each other on up to like the very day that they're going to feature. So that morning, you know, of Thursday, you know, usually Thursday is when everyone launches the big games or whatever. So like say that Thursday morning, they'll look at the games that they've been considering and they'll make a decision like at noon or something, like when they're going to feature, and then they release it.
So why is it Thursday? Is that like a special day for some
reason? I have no idea.
It's right before the weekend or something?
A special day. I think because the weekend is coming. I think it's because Friday, Saturday are their highest downloading
day. Yeah, so like all your app downloads are going to be on Friday, Saturday, Sunday. As for, and especially iOS in particular, a lot of it is based on your velocity in those days. But it's the same with all app stores. Sure. And you want to have the most downloads when you start your app because exactly. That's how high your rank is. So if your first days are Friday, Saturday, Sunday, you'll have more downloads than if your first day was Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday.
Exactly.
Now, why Thursday and not Friday is because the first day you're out in the store, it's not going to be live right away. It's going to take a few hours. You know, you might get live on the West Coast, and then a few hours later, you're live on the East Coast.
Right.
Maybe
right.
by noon, you're live in Tokyo. And no matter what, your first day is going to be not as good as your second day. You're kind of guaranteed.
Yeah. Plus, there's always like just unforeseen things that happen in the first day.
Okay. So getting approved, depending on how long that process takes, you want to submit your app at a time where you know it's going to be in store.
You can set it afterwards. So there's two ways when you do the submission proof process. This works for all app stores, Windows, Android. Actually, not Android. You just go live when you go live. But for Nook, Apple, and Windows, you can either go live as soon as it's approved or launch at a certain time. And you always want to launch at a certain time because that way you can launch right at midnight on a day. Even if it's not a Thursday, it's always better for your ranking to launch, after you've been approved and, wait for submission.
Gotcha. Cool. Good to know. Thursday. Boom.
Yep. Sorry for that Thursday tangent. So you launched the game. You got featured. Was it that day, the first day you got featured?
Right. And so the way it works is that basically, they told us we were considered being featured. So we sent them the artwork and we just kind of crossed our fingers. And so on Thursday morning, the app was live essentially, but we weren't featured. And so it wasn't until like noon or something that they turned it on, and then we didn't even find out. Like, someone sent us from Corona, said, "Hey, you guys are like featured on the UK App Store," and we just got sent a screenshot because at the time we didn't know how to like access the UK version of the App Store, and so we were like, "Oh, that's awesome!" And we thought, "Oh, maybe we're just featured in the UK." But then as the day went on, we were featured in the US and all these other countries, and it was amazingly exciting. To see our game on the App Store featured like that. So that was like a huge high, and we were just like, just looking at our rankings the entire day, we were just like, oh, we're at 75, oh, we're at 45, and like, I don't know how high we got. I think we got to like maybe 30s or something like that at the time. So that was really exciting. And then at the time, the market, like, we were like, okay, we're featured. And we got awesome reviews and lots of people downloading. And since we had gone with a free-to-play model, the fact of like getting all those downloads didn't necessarily mean we were going to be millionaires, right? So we were just kind of like waiting for the money to roll in.
So
unfortunately, that did not pan out. Like our IAP, our monetization, we had put almost zero thought into that. We just assumed if people liked the game, they would pay into the game.
Yeah, I mean, that is like the one, from a design standpoint, critique I can find is that your in-app purchases are kind of optional. So it's a problem that Blast Monkeys ran into, my game, because you have a level-based puzzle game, similar to Blast Monkeys in that sense. And you had these consumables. Actually, you might be best to describe this. Why don't you like describe your game and the monetization for it?
Yeah, I mean, it's essentially like a lot. At the time, the big thing was was making these casual arcade games, kind of like Angry Birds or whatever, that are level based and sort of like puzzles. And the only consumables that we had, the only IAP, were consumables. They were basically power ups, and they basically just helped you in the game. So it helped you either slow down the game so you could complete the game, complete the level easier, or let you try again from like a save point, and all these other little power-ups that basically helped you beat the level. And we thought, that would pan out because we saw, oh, well, Angry Birds had this like eagle thing where
so
they could just,
you can
like,
only get those by paying coin, or you could earn it in the game, right? The currency.
Yes, you could earn currency in the game and pay for it that way. And so ultimately, the only IAP we had was purchasing that currency.
So did you play test that? Did you fine tune like how much you're gaining or volume? You just kind of go, it's close enough, people will buy that.
Well, more of the latter. We definitely play tested the difficulty and how much, you know, currency we give out, as well as how to price the power ups. However, we did not actually, you know, test it in a market and see whether anyone would pay for it.
So you didn't like give your beta testers like X amount of coins and say, hey, you play this game, but you only have like 5 coins and he has like 500.
Yeah. We didn't have any beta testing at all.
Did you have analytics in the game when it launched?
We did. We threw in a bunch of like Flurry stuff.
So you're collecting data once you had the users. So, all right, it turns out people don't buy this power up, or everyone's only buying that one, or people are earning way more coin and are not paying for it because they just will play this level 5 times and then not have to pay.
Right. And so most of the data that we got, the useful data, was sort of like where people were dropping off in terms of which levels, you know, and stuff like that. But in terms of purchases, we had so few that it wasn't statistically like it was so low. It was just like, okay, something's broken. Like, this is either this game will not, you know, sell IAP the way we have it, or, you know, we're not selling the right IAP.
So do you mind if I ask you like an incredibly rude personal question?
Say yes.
How many downloads did you have?
How many downloads?
Yeah. I find out that is always like, I get that every time you talk about, I'm an app developer. How many downloads do you have? It's like, you're just judging me by that number. You know?
I hate
that's why I stopped keeping track of downloads, because I just hated that question. But people out there, I'm sure, are asking that. So like, give us a ballpark idea. We're talking hundreds of thousands, millions.
Yeah. I mean, I think within that first month, we had gotten close to 2 million.
Holy!
You had 2 million.
Yeah.
That is incredible success.
Like, Why didn't you, after the first couple weekends, just all of a sudden jack the price up to $1? You could have at least ended up with like a couple thousand right there.
Well, yeah. I mean,
so that's the big question, right? Because we were like, you know, we're not, the IAP isn't succeeding. Do we do something to fix that IAP, or do we just go straight to paid? Well, and ultimately, once the feature was over, you know, and that's 2 weeks, I think, the amount of downloads just dramatically drops, like right off the cliff, right?
And yeah, but you're always going to get more when you're featured, no matter what.
Right. So unfortunately, we had not made that decision quick enough to really monetize on it. We did switch it back to 99 cents eventually, but by that time, honestly, it was too late.
I don't even think it was necessarily that like your game could have worked as freemium. You didn't follow through with the monetization and doing that testing and figuring out, okay, how does it work? How much do I earn this? What in-app purchases make sense? And you weren't getting a conversion ratio that was profitable for you guys. You know, it's like,
yeah. I mean, the thing is, honestly, I actually haven't heard of a level-based puzzler game that has made a lot on IAP. In terms of the games that have high profile, the games that have done it in terms of casual arcade games, you know, Temple Run, maybe Jetpack Joyride, and definitely Subway Surfer. Right?
No, I mean, I think a lot of games have made it in IAP. I think just having in-app purchases in general does not guarantee people want to buy it, right? Exactly what those ratios really matter. And we're talking like fine tuned detail. You know, you're talking a 1% increase in coin gain could be the difference between $10,000 a month or not. Like that, that kind of detail really, really matters, especially when you're a consumable based game.
Right.
Because you want people to constantly be buying, you want people to be flowing. And, you know, what I really want to talk with you about, actually, is your post-release content, because, when did you get your first update out for the game?
So we had updated our shop. That was our, like, main update. And that was, like, maybe one of the only updates we've done after that. Like, we literally just gave up on the game, like, pretty quickly. And the update was to the store.
Within a month, within a week?
Within like 2 months, I'd say. Totally done with the game. Yeah.
Man, you had 2 million downloads in a month, and you gave up
developing it for 8 months too.
You know, I think part of it was maybe that you had that burnout, right? Like you were working on it for so long, but freemium games are not those kind of fire and forget, right? You have to constantly iterate with people, and you had 2 million users before you were ready for 2 million users, right? Like one of the advantages that I've had with Blast Monkeys, and one of the reasons why I recommend the release early and often model, is that you get it in front of people early. You know, that's not going to work. This is going to work. These features are bare. This in-app purchase doesn't work. And you're dealing with that when you have thousands of players. And then months later, as you grow organically, then maybe you start doing your pushes, whatever you need to do. Then when you have 2 million players, you know the game is more solid. Because if you have an issue that, say, makes 1% of the players unhappy, right? Or maybe it's 1% of players will not purchase something when they would have if the game had been slightly better or slightly tweaked.
Right.
You know, 1% of 2 million, that's a lot of money right there.
Yeah, well, it's a little deceptive to say that since you have 2 million downloads, you have 2 million daily active users. And that wasn't really true.
Oh, interesting. So were your users not very sticky in general?
Well, that's not true with any game, right? Retention in terms of downloads.
Well, yeah, it's always going to be smaller than 2 million. But, you know, you had a lot of eyeballs in that game, right? Even game, I've talked to developers who have, say, 30,000 DAU. Right. And they're making, you know, 5 to 10,000 a month, which, you know, that's not like rich money. That's not fuck you money, pardon my language. But that's, you know, that's diaper money right there. That's like some decent change.
Yeah. I mean, you and I, Dubai, have talked about this a lot, and Don as well. And I
know I've hounded you guys too much. That's the polite way of saying that. Like,
no,
I go up to you guys and
hounding.
Why, guys, you should have updated. Yeah,
yeah.
He's fangirling all over you. I'm sorry.
and the reason is, and it has nothing to do with like who's right or who's wrong. It's purely from what time, when did you enter the market? And what was your strategy, right? And what game were you making? And for us, when we had entered the market, it was the entire industry was learning that monetizing free-to-play games was hard. And two, didn't really overlap with certain type of game genres. And ultimately, the decision that Don and I made was that the game Cannon Cat had a ceiling, had a glass ceiling in terms of how well it would monetize. We could spend a lot of time, like you said, iterating and getting that, you know, extra 0.5%, you know, extra money to help us. But ultimately, like you said, we had spent like a whole year basically developing this game. Were we willing to put the time and effort into making that, you know, that effort to make it monetize? And honestly, at that point, we were like, no, like we rather work on a better game that monetizes better, but also that we were more excited about working on.
Yeah,
and
I think another point too is I asked you guys, like, I forgot when, but I asked, like, do you play Cannon Cat still? Like, in your spare time, you just pull it out and play it every now and then?
Honestly, or? I do not. No, I do not play.
So, like, I play Blast Monkey still.
I know.
I'm weird, maybe, but I, you know, there is something to be said about, like, it's got to be a game that you really feel passionate
exactly.
for. Because
exactly.
you have to be, like, there's no other way to be successful at it monetarily unless you're also really passionate about the game.
Right. Yeah, I mean, at the time, I was absolutely in love with my game. But at some point, you kind of have to make that decision. Like, it was a hard decision. And it was very, you know, honestly, emotionally taxing on me to imagine. I mean, just imagine, like, getting 2 million downloads and then having really nothing to show for it, like, monetarily. It was a hard decision to sort of give up on it. But I think ultimately it was the best decision for Don and I, because the game that we're working on now is something, like you said, that we would play a lot and we're very passionate about and we think has a long lifetime. You know, with Can and Cat, the amount of effort it took to make that level of polish levels, like, constantly, to get that content to come out, would be really, really difficult for us. We're trying to make a game that sort of scales up, like, a lot better.
Right.
So, talk about Prestige. Like, when did you start it? Like, 2 months after Can and Cat, you started designing it? Did it take, like, you take a 6 month break? Like,
yeah, I mean, it took many months for us to figure out how to pivot, right? Because, like you said, we had sort of set our hopes on this first game, and it didn't pan out the way that we wanted. But we learned a lot from it. Really, the spawn of Prestige, which is, you know, basically a Wizard Academy simulation. Think of Harry Potter, but you're playing Dumbledore, right?
So cool.
So that actually came from a bunch of prototypes. I had been doing a bunch of small prototypes and sort of throwing ideas at Don. And I said that, you know, just to back out, I want to make a game where players are given these pieces and they don't know where they belong or what the potential is of each of these pieces, but they experiment. They do trial and error, and then they figure out how to grow these pieces into something better. And so it's very abstract, right?
But so it's kind of like a Roller Coaster Tycoon-esque is how I get that vibe from it.
Right. So it's ultimately the game is like it's like a Kairosoft game. You're building your school and you're training wizards. And, you know, Don had taken my abstract idea and basically said, hey, that sounds like a school. And we were like, well, school's kind of boring, so how can a school be less boring? And like, oh, well, magic, you know. And Harry Potter, you know, the movies were done. And so we were like, hey, there's a gap we can fill here. Like, there's clearly people who like this idea, and we can make it into a really meaningful and, you know, interesting game. So we have, you know, the school building side of the game, as well as the sort of typical RPG mission side of the game. So when you send your wizards out on missions, you can actually see them, you know, attacking monsters and help them out. And cool. You gain rewards through those missions to then invest back into your school.
So how long have you been working on the game at this point? This is about a year now, has it been?
Oh, man. I think so.
It's December.
Yeah.
if that helps you at all.
Yeah, it's been, yeah, actually it's been about a year. And ultimately, we're still like early in development. So honestly, it's probably going to take us 2 years to make this game.
So when do you think, when is your aim date? For completing it?
Next year. I don't know when next year, but next year.
So like 2014 next year? Or like 2015 next year?
So I'm assuming you guys are not doing this full-time anymore. You've...
Oh, no, we are doing this full-time.
Oh, yeah, you are?
Oh.
Yeah.
So you're planning for the long haul to bootstrap it?
Yes. Yeah, we've just been burning through our savings like crazy.
You haven't sought any funding or
do another, what was it, a lock?
Sprite lock.
Yeah, do another Sprite
just
lock.
Just remake Sprite lock real quick. Just make another hit tool real quick.
Yeah, you know, MVD.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we sort of don't want to be distracted from game development. But,
right.
You know, we had put our feelers out there for investors, but the feedback we were getting was that no one's really investing in game companies unless you already have traction. You already have a game out there that has growth and users. So, and then, you know, obviously there's, you know, a lot of people are doing Kickstarter for PC type games that are paid, you know, games. And that has been pretty successful for other indies. But for, you know, free to play mobile games, we haven't really seen that be all that successful in terms of crowdfunding. But, you know, we're willing to try whatever when we need it. But at this point, we're fine with just bootstrapping it and spending all of our time on the game.
So is it still just the two of you, or have you gotten anyone else involved in the team, contractors, another partner?
No, it's actually just the two of us still. So I'm still doing all the artwork and UI, and Don is on the tech side and handling all that stuff. So
When do you think you'll get it in hands of playtesters?
I'm hoping we'll get it to them in a few months. Don is still, like, in terms of the tech side, we're working on an HTML5 sort of framework. And that's so that we could have it on the web and people could easily mm-hmm. access it. So we don't have to worry about, like, whether they're on Android or iOS or whatever and formatting it for mobile at that point.
So are you planning for desktop browsers, or are you planning it for all browsers? Like, I go to a web page on my mobile.
Hopefully any browser, yeah, okay. Whether it be on your mobile or desktop. But, you know, we probably envision most people will beta test on their desktop browsers just for ease of use. But everything is going to be designed for mobile. So right now, as I'm designing all the UI and all the characters and everything, I'm testing on mobile to see, you know, whether it's the right size, where all the buttons are going to be right for mobile. So ultimately, we want to make, you know, this for mobile and for tablets. But just for beta testing purposes, we're using HTML5.
Cool. Smart.
Yeah, so we're really excited about it, and we think this is a really great game that's going to, you know, really become a business for us, and that's what we're hoping to get out of it.
So you're going for the freemium model again?
Yes.
So talk, like, it's still early in development. You haven't set things in stone, but what kind of lessons are you taking for that, like, after Cannon Cat? What are you going to do right. to try and not have that same whatever problems there were before?
Right. Well, ultimately, the big change is that, you know, this is an appointment-style type game. You know, things will take time in the game. Because you can imagine, like, in a school, it makes sense. You know, like, if you're training wizards, the class time is going to take, you know, some certain amount of time. Researching spells is going to take some resources and our time. And so on that front, we've seen enough analogs in the market to prove that, you know, hey, those types of games do monetize. Because ultimately, people have a choice that they're willing to make. Do I spend time on this game, or do I, you know, spend some extra money to sort of get through this part a little quicker, you know, to get immediate satisfaction? Ultimately, there's no pay to win, you know, aspect to our game. We're still, and it's not really like a win or lose type game either, right? Because you can imagine your school could be developing over months, maybe even years, you know, depending on how long, you know, we're gonna spend on this game. But we're hoping that we can have people play this game for years, you know. And so that takes a lot more time, you know, to build that infrastructure of, you know, content that can be easily updated, live ops and stuff like that. And so ultimately, you know, on the one hand, we have this, you know, time management appointment style game, which we know, like, monetizes fairly well on the market. And then on the other side, with the RPG mission side, we know there's a lot of examples of games where, you know, you could sell certain premium items that you can use, like health potions, you know, shields, equipment, weapons, etc., that'll help you, you know, get through, you know, particularly difficult missions. But ultimately, you know, we want people to fall in love with the game and build a relationship with the game over many days, over many months. And so it's all about, you know, making this your own school and making decisions for the school and exploring the world, because, you know, there's different entities in the world that will ask for your help, you know, and as well as the NPCs in the game, we're trying to make real characters that you interact with. We're not going to have the shopkeeper be this, you know, static 2D thing that just sells you things and, you know, that, you know, is just a regular store that the developers put in there to make money. Like, we want you to have a relationship with the shopkeeper. If you help the shopkeeper, if you save them from, I don't know, from a monster attacking him, he'll give you a discount. Or, you know, you can come to him and he'll just have random stories to tell you about, you know, his adventures. Or maybe you'll find a secret artifact on one of your missions and you ask him, hey, I got this piece of an amulet. What does this mean? Like, what is this thing? And he'll tell you, oh, this is very valuable. You should keep it. You might find the other half and it'll give you this special power.
And that, like, kind of adds a viral aspect too, because as I'm playing it and, you know, say talking to Catherine about the game, it's like, oh man, my shopkeeper, he did this for me. And
yeah. Exactly.
Like, oh, it creates these stories. It's a reason exactly. to talk to somebody else.
Right. We want to create imagination and curiosity within the player, but also a sense of of mutability, of the world is alive, that it reacts to you and as well as changes. And that's what really makes a game sort of, at least from our experience, like the thing that makes us enamored with games is like these surprises, these things that change, things that basically are affected by your actions, you know. Mm-hmm. And we think there's a lot of potential in free to play games. It gets a lot of slack from a lot of gamers, people who have traditionally grown up with games. They look at free to play as this evil thing, and as developers, you know, the onus is on us to prove them wrong.
Yeah, people look at it that way, but it's only a certain audience. You know, if you look at the majority of people out there, the majority of people love free to play, and it enables more people to really enjoy a game. Like those kids who don't have money, you know, they can play hundreds of games for free now. They're in a better place in the world because of it.
Right. They have a choice to not pay or not.
You know, back in the day when we were growing up, you had to pay $60 a cartridge. You'd have like one or two games. You had to go to your neighbors. Like,
you had to save up so much money. Yeah.
And not that those games shouldn't exist, but there's now also other games too.
Right. Exactly. It's just a different market. It's a different type of game.
Yeah. I'm really looking forward to Prestige. Like I've only seen, you know, some of the videos you post online, your screenshots you have on Facebook, but man, it's really exciting. I love the passion you have into it. It is a very complex game. This is not a trivial, you know, throw it up there, do some numbers.
Yeah.
There's a lot of depth to this project. So like it does, you know, the 2 years of development estimated time sounds like a long time,
but
which it honestly it is. It's a very, very long time, but you know, it looks like you're putting in 2 years of work into it, you know, to really just get have the deep experience. And I can't wait to get my hands on it. So speaking of which, you're saying you're looking for beta testers. Like, where should people go if they're interested in trying it out?
So the URL is lockhart.com, lokhart.com, and then / prestige, and then / sign up, signup, and then / one.
Yeah. So
how do you spell heart again?
Let's go over again. It's lockhart.com, lokhart.com, / prestige, prestige, / sign up.
And these are
/ one, actually.
Oh,
because we had two different sign up pages, and we were like, why are we doing this?
So
we
I'll make sure I throw a link in the podcast description.
Yes, please.
As well. You can go look there. You don't need to remember that by heart. You could also go to facebook.com/ prestige the game, prestige the game. And has a bunch of screenshots and all sorts of stuff that you can learn more about the project.
Yeah, to give you guys a sense of sort of what it looks like, it's sort of a pixel art type game, kind of in the same vein of like a Kairosoft game. So if you do like, you know, sort of retro graphics but with a modern feel to it, then you'll definitely love Prestige. And if you love Harry Potter or just RPG games in general and want to have a casual...
I love all those things.
Yeah.
Ravenclaw, that's the best one.
No, that's a lie. Slytherin / Gryffindor.
Gryffindor, yeah.
Are you going to have different houses in the game, a la Harry Potter?
We're not taking exactly that world. So we won't have different houses within your school.
Yeah, but I guess you don't want to be like
principal.
You don't want to be Harry Potter off-brand. You want to have your own wizarding school.
Exactly. Yeah. So you'll see some inspirations from Harry Potter, some from Lord of the Rings, some from, you know, typical RPG type games. So it's a world that you're somewhat familiar with, but will have surprises and different takes on it entirely. So we hope we're creating our own interesting world. It'll feel familiar enough that you won't be surprised or have to learn something like incredibly new or different, you know.
Sounds great. So now we're wrapping up the show. I always like to bring up what games you've been playing lately, because as developers, we don't just want to make games. You have to go out there and play them, because that's what you learn. You know, if you want to look at it from a complete technical point of view, it's market analysts, right? It's, you know, figuring out what's out there. But really, it's just being inspired by other stuff.
Right.
And for me, I finally got around to playing the Stanley Parable.
Oh,
which
wow.
It's been a while. I know I should have played it sooner, but oh, man, that game is... unique. It's pretty cool, right? There's weirder games, there's zanier games, there's crazier games, there's is it really a game? It is a whole other question. But what it is, I think, is a piece of art. Like, I think the ideal setting for that game is in an art gallery. Very meta. Not just, you know, from a comedy point of view, but just critiquing how games are made. Like, I can't, you know, show that to someone who isn't a hardcore gamer and have them get it.
It's a game about games.
Yeah exactly. It's very, very weird and unique. What about you, Catherine? What have you been playing lately?
I have been playing Mass Effect, since I have not played it before, and I know nothing about the story because I was avoiding all spoilers.
So you're playing the first years. Mass Effect. You're going through in order?
Yeah, in order, the very first one, and I am not far into it at all.
So who have you slept with so far?
No, I am like... I'm the type of person, I'm like, oh, a side mission. Let me do that. La, 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 la. Oh, I got lost. Crap. Oh, there's a map. Still don't know how to use it. I am like the quintessential will get lost no matter what. Go around in circles. Normally, it'll take an average person do a mission in like, what, 30 minutes? It'll take me 4 hours because I'll get lost and I won't know where to go.
I only played Mass Effect 1. I didn't play any of the sequels. I hear the later ones get better for that exploring stuff. Because the first one was very linear of like, oh, you're on this planet. There's a thing to do in this planet. And otherwise, you're just kind of wandering
around. Yeah, I've just gotten to the exploring the planets. And I'm like, oh, God, I'm going to get lost. I'm going to, like, forget where I've been and what I've done. But so far, so good. I really like it. I'll tell you more, like, next week or after Christmas or after the holidays, after New Year's, after my birthday.
I don't know when this is going to air, but this is being recorded before Christmas.
Yeah, hint, hint.
Yeah. All right, what about you, David? What have you been playing?
Oh, man, I've been playing a lot of games. A lot of console games just to sort of pass the time, like some really like kind of older FPS games. Like I played Max Payne 3 really quickly. I played Killzone 3 really quickly. But then Don and I have actually been having some game nights together playing Dynasty Warriors 8 and some Street Fighter. So, we're just playing a lot of console games. But on the indie game route, I've been going on GameJolt.com and just playing a lot of like free like indie games. And there was one I tried. It was called you're basically breaking into a house, and then you had a shopping list of things to steal. And
is this the Jason Roher one?
Oh, it's called The Very Organized Thief.
No, I don't think it's that one.
Anyone can get it. It's free. It's on GameJolt.com, and it's really interesting because the shopping list changes every time that you play a new game. And so you go around the house and you look for these things before the homeowner gets home. And then when the homeowner gets home, you hear them pull up on the driveway. And then that tells you, okay, I have a certain amount of time. And then you see them like – you hear them like jingling the keys trying to get in the door. And so basically your goal is to get as much stuff on your shopping list before you escape. And so you have to figure out like which entrance they're coming in as well. And all this is in the dark and you have just like a flashlight too. So,
Interesting. What's it called again?
The Very Organized Thief.
I will have to, I will look that up later and check it out.
Awesome.
Very cool. So if you want to find more episodes of Be Indie Now, you can go to beindienow.com. You have all the episodes there, descriptions, links, if you don't want to have to type in that link to sign up for the beta test. If you want to find out more about me, you can go to my website, tobiamarks.com. It's my blog. I have hopefully interesting information I throw up there about game development, or you could follow me on Twitter at tobiamarks. Where can we find more about you, Catherine?
You can find me on Twitter at Kat V. Harris. That's like V as in victory.
V as in victory.
Yeah, and then Harris. Yeah.
Cool. Mm-hmm. What about you, David? Where should we find
anyone,
you?
Yeah, I mean, if anyone wants to talk more about indie game development, or if you have any questions, or hell, if you have any advice or feedback on what I've said in the podcast, or Prestige, you want to find out more, just email me. I'm just david@lockhart.com. So it's LOQHEART.com. David. It's easy.
Perfect. Thank you very much for being on the show. and telling us your story.
Yeah.
Thanks.
All right. Thank you. Bye. Go out there and make some games. I forgot my tagline. I'm doing the show for so long.
I was like, wait,
every show I've been saying go out there and make some games. All right. Go out there and make some games.